One is, do not let instruments dry out at the end of an operation. Always keep them in a moist, not wet, atmosphere. Do not use swabbing methodologies for telling you whether there is residual protein on surgical instruments, because swabbing does not efficiently bring off protein, and then is usually not a very good chemical test either. If you can get the residual protein on a surgical instrument down to less than 5 micrograms on one side of an instrument, we can reduce the risks within the population of transmission of prion protein.
Every day, they slay the dragons of healthcare-acquired infections and dangerous microbial fire breathers. While you may not see them during your next hospital stay, they will be there, ensuring the safest possible surgeries by skillfully wielding their disinfecting weapons of mass microbial destruction. They are sterile processing professionals. And this is Beyond Clean, the central nexus for the people, processes, and products that are pushing the global sterile processing industry forward. Join us every week as we introduce you to the unsung heroes who are fighting dirty around the globe. And now, it's time to go Beyond Clean.
This week on Beyond Clean, we speak with Dr. David Parrott, professor of bioanalytical science at Bart and the London School of Medicine. Dr. Parrott recently retired as a professor, becoming emeritus of bioanalytical science at Bart's Medical College in London. And since 1999, he has undertaken UK Department of Health funded decontamination research and sits on a number of government research committees. This research includes optimization of washers, disinfectors, both in the laboratory and in sterile processing departments. His interests also include separation science applied to human diseases and drug analysis in biofluids. His work on decontamination of surgical instruments in relation to VCJD for the UK Department of Health was featured on the BBC and has been mentioned in the British Parliament. He holds patents on devices for use in residual protein detection that have been marketed from 2013 on. He lectures both nationally and internationally, and Dr. Parrott has authored or co-authored 185 papers in peer-reviewed scientific journals, 30 books and chapters, and has over 40 contributions in the proceedings of conferences, academic societies, etc. His most recent book is called Gout at Your Fingertips, and Dr. Parrott was recently involved with the rewrite of the UK HTM guidelines, which were published in 2017. So obviously, Mike, today we're speaking with an expert. We're going to get a little bit of detail that may be beyond what you and I are used to hearing and maybe even our listening audience. But I think it's really important how much that we understand how dangerous this could be. I know we talked a lot similarly on this topic with Dr. Christine Green in one of our previous episodes, a lot of overlap. And even there's comments that Dr. Parrott will make about point of use cleaning and its importance, or at least he'll allude to it. So I'm really excited to have this interview today.
Yeah, this is really an exciting one because, CJD, VCJD are kind of the boogeymen of sterile processing, and then by extension to the OR. When you consider, what is specifically at risk, you're talking about a condition that has a 100% mortality rate. If you get it, you will die. And it's a really kind of awful way to go out. So, this is something that is particularly scary, and it doesn't fit into our normal categories of bacteria, virus, fungus. It just doesn't fit into those categories. So, there's a lot to learn here, and the stakes couldn't be higher when we talk about what exactly is at risk.
HealthMark has intelligent solutions for your cleaning verification program, including products to measure water temperature, water quality, cleaning efficacy, and directly test for residual soil left on instruments. Find your tools for cleaning verification at hmark.com.
There you will learn about our TOSI and SonoCheck that test the performance of mechanical washers as recommended in sterilization standards guidelines. Other products like CartWash Check test for mechanical efficiency and target temperature. The ProCheck 2 can detect residual protein to a very low level. Go to hmark.com today for all of your cleaning verification testing needs. It's 2023 and there's big news for IST. A closed warning letter, a new product launch, and a 10-year anniversary. OneTray IST has a lot to celebrate this year. OneTray's 2006 cleared 48-hour storage claim was acknowledged by the FDA, and the company is pushing forward, offering the total solution for reprocessing. OneTray maximizes reprocessing time. EasyTracks adds flexibility with instrument organization, and their upcoming product, OneCart, a sealed case cart with a smaller footprint and a perfect option for offsite sterilization, completes the total solution. Experience a year of efficiency with OneTray. For more information on the closure of the warning letter, visit OneTray.com/FDA warning letter. That's OneTray.com/FDA warning letter. Otherwise, you can reach out to the company by calling 937-619-0138 or visit OneTray.com/contact.
You're listening to Beyond Clean, the global voice of sterile processing.
Joining us now is Dr. David Perret, professor of bioanalytical science at Barts and the London School of Medicine. And Dr. Perret, we're going to talk about prions and CJD today, which is something that you have a great deal of experience with in the UK, which I think makes you a tremendous expert to talk about this with our listeners on the show. So thank you for joining us.
Hello. Good morning. Well, it's good afternoon here in London.
Yeah, I know. We always have to coordinate the timing of our interviews, but maybe we could start with just talking about what a prion is and defining that. I'm not sure that everybody is really clear. I understand it's a protein, and I think a lot of people have some basic knowledge in that regard, but take us a little bit deeper so that everybody understands what we're talking about today.
Okay, a prion is a protein, as you just said. But as the unusual ability for proteins of being infectious. Now, that means there is no DNA there, so it's not like a virus, it's not like a bacteria. The protein itself is infectious in the sense that it causes other prion proteins, and I'm afraid to say our bodies have got lots of prions in them. We don't know why, but we have lots of prions in our brain and other tissues. And when it meets what we call a misfolded protein, it causes the nearby proteins to all become misfolded. Eventually, that leads to holes in, say, brain material, in brain matter, and those holes are what we now term transmissible spongiform encephalopathy.
Wow. Yeah. So you've already got me scared with all the information about the prions inside of me.
It's an infectious protein. Can I tell you maybe just how infectious it is?
Yeah, please.
If you've got an animal model, such as a mouse, that's got BCJD, yeah, I suppose we really should clarify what we talk. We are talking about basically forms of Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, and often abbreviated to VCJD. So if we have a mouse that's got VCJD and we literally cut into its brain, maybe only just stick a pin into it, and we then stick that pin into the brain of another mouse, that second mouse will get VCJD.
When you take the pin, from one mouse brain to the other, do they contract it every single time?
I should think, yes, almost every time, yes. It is so infectious. And it was first, the history of prion disease extends back. Pusnier won the Nobel Prize for it back in, I think, the 1980s for demonstrating this infectivity, this extreme infectivity of something that was just a protein, no DNA, no RNA, to be seen in the tissue sample. So it is a very, very infectious material. And in fact, there is a beautiful example of this from Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, as against mad cow disease type things, back in 1976. I could give you the full reference, but a brain electrode was used on a patient who got CJD. A few months later, that same electrode was used on a second patient, having been cleaned in a normal manner, appropriate at that time, 1970s, and then used on a second patient, and that second patient then got CJD as well. And then the electrode cleaned, no one was suspecting anything, cleaned again, and used on a third patient who got CJD again after a few months. The electrode was then sent to, I think, your Center for Disease Control in the States, and then it was used on a monkey, and that monkey got CJD some 3 or so years later after the first case. So that just gives you some idea of how infectious this is.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I guess I wanted to go, you know, all the way back to your definition even of a prion. And I know I've heard this conversation before in the industry, but in sterile processing or in SSDs, you know, we are so used to killing things through disinfection and through sterilization, but there's really no such thing as killing a prion because it's a protein, correct?
There is no such thing as killing a prion without doing serious damage to the instrument it is attached to. You can kill a prion by boiling it in strong caustic soda, but if you've ever done that to a surgical instrument, it's not a pretty object that comes out at the end of the process. It's a very blackened instrument, damaged. So what we lack are ways able to kill prion infectivity in a simple way. There have been a number of commercial detergents developed that say they will do this job, but many of them have used as their model a forms of prion, such as scrapie prion. I need to say a little bit more about where we can find prions in a moment. Scrapie prion from sheep, and that's really quite relatively easy to kill off that one. It's the CJD, the VCJD prions that are the difficult ones to kill.
In terms of our understanding of the scope of this problem, obviously you went in depth for the danger and the infectiousness of this protein. But really, in the medical device space on a global scale, what are we talking about here? What's the true scope of this issue?
Well, we can't be absolutely certain, but just telling you a little on the history here. Mad cow disease occurred in the UK in the 1990s, and it has been in other countries, and may well have been around for some ages before that. Now, what happened was mad cow disease jumped the species barrier, and it moved into man, and there was a rapid increase in the number of cases of VCJD. And they're not like CJD is basically a neurological disease of older people. VCJD, human mad cow disease, was a very much a disease of young people, teenagers in particular. and it could be related to them having possibly eaten contaminated beef. So there's this ability to jump the species. But then, having risen rapidly in the early 2000s, 2000, 2005, it seems to have plateaued. I've gone past the plateau and come back down. There has not been a case of VCJD in the UK now for 4 years. And the total number of VCJD deaths is currently 178, that is all. But there are some other, it has been reported in other countries. There are probably about 100 cases from other countries of VCJD. So it is still out there. And the real worry is that epidemiological statisticians start talking about, well, there could be another wave coming, and there could be it coming from other sources, because prions are to be found in, as I said earlier, in scrapie in sheep, and that's been known for centuries. There was the case of cannibals who on South Sea Island is called, with the tribe called, who produce a disease called Kuru, because they used to eat the brains of their dead relatives in order to inherit, in inverted commas, their wisdom. But in fact, what they gave themselves was a neurological prion disease. And then for you in the States, you have a very massive number of wild animals that have got something called chronic wasting disease, which is in deer, elks, and that kind of thing, reindeer. And it spread rapidly. And I don't know the latest figures, but as far as I know, none of this has, it's gone, it's in almost every state now in the US. It has chronic wasting disease, has jumped into small animals in woodlands by eating dead carcasses. It has not yet jumped the species barrier into man. That could be really worrying if it did.
Yeah, well, and it's funny because you are leading me right to my next question, which is, all right, so we know that VCJD jumps species, but are there any other instances or cases where we've seen prions jump species, like you just described? Obviously, there's one that hasn't yet, but would be potentially devastating if it did. Do we have other instances where it's moved from one species to another?
Well, obviously, mad cow has jumped species. You've had a small species jump in your chronic wasting disease in the States. But strangely, although we've had scrapie in the sheep population for at least 500 years, that apparently has never jumped species, and we eat lamb and mutton and that without really worrying about scrapie. Although I would say the agricultural people are now trying to remove it from the sheep population. So I'm not aware of any others, other than we can do it in the laboratory quite easily by that technique of just touching the brain of one, moving it into another animal. So you could move it from a mouse to a rat, mouse to a rabbit. Yes, you can do that kind of jump.
So Dr. Parrott, we've talked about how infectious this prion can be, but you mentioned that there have been no cases now in the UK for 4 years. What do you attribute that dramatic decline to?
Probably the government's restrictions that they brought in on meat processing. In other words, we're not allowed to eat animal brain anymore in the UK. We're not allowed to eat the spinal cord. This has all got to be removed. So the prion infective tissues are now out of the food chain. This has helped. But can I qualify this statement?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, there have been a reduction in the number of VCJD cases, but throughout the world, there is a rapidly rising number of CJD, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease cases. We've now, in the UK, although we've had 178 cases of VCJD, we've had something like 2,500 cases of Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease that have been reported. And the same prion is there, and that same prion is just as able to stick to a surgical instrument in a CJD case as it is for a BCJD case.
So more specifically to the sterile processing world, you know, were there processes that were changed to help mitigate the risk of transmitting a prion disease through surgical instruments?
Within the UK, definitely. And what was done there, I mentioned in your bio at the beginning that I'd been on the government committee for decontamination of surgical instruments, sort of in brackets, prion disease, since 1999. The UK government has directly spent something like, if I put it into dollar terms for you, something like $30 million on research into how to clean surgical instruments better. That's probably the biggest spend on decontamination research anywhere. And that has rolled forward, and then the accumulation of all that research has been the HTM 0101, which was published exactly 2 years ago and can be seen on the UK government's Department of Health website. It can be studied there. And it came to a number of simple conclusions, which I could talk about if you wish.
I think that'd be helpful, Dr. Parrott, to give a little bit of insight, because I know with our international audiences there, and this is a phrase even that has come up again and again and again from our previous guests. I'm thinking in particular of Rene Weiss, who likes to say that these microorganisms do not respect international boundaries, right? And so because they don't act any differently in the UK than they do in Asia and they do in the States, the question then becomes, why, as a healthcare community on a global scale, why do we treat them differently depending on where we are? Now, obviously, we know because there's different guiding documents, et cetera, but it's because of this focus in the UK. I think it'd be helpful if you could summarize some of the highlights of those guiding documents.
I'll try and summarize. When we first started this research back in 1999 or a year after that, when the funding was in place, I asked a very simple question of the committee. Well, at the end of an operation, how much material is there on a surgical instrument? And we studied that. And in fact, the amount of tissue on an instrument could be as much as 50 to 100 milligrams. And that you've got to wash off. So that was the first object. Then we said, well, how do you test for the residual protein? You can look at instruments, yes, and you can see large quantities if they're inspected properly. But the other point was that you simply test. And the standard test in the ISO international standard is one called ninhydrin and swabbing with ninhydrin. I studied this and showed that it was impossible for the ninhydrin test to actually work because ninhydrin doesn't actually react with proteins with any degree of sensitivity. There was then a national study done of how efficiently did SSDs throughout Britain actually perform. And I'm afraid to say they performed on the whole badly. So we now come to then doing more research, better tests. And I must say there is no test to measure, no biochemical test to measure prions, and certainly not at the levels that they're infectious. The infectivity of a prion is we only need approximately 1,000 molecules to transmit BCJD, and that 1,000 molecules could easily be stuck on the surface of a used instrument or an endoscope or whatever. So we've got a number of things. We've got to now look at new methods. Lots of studies went on, and some of the outcomes that are in the HTM, I will try and summarize. One is do not let instruments dry out at the end of an operation. always keep them in a moist, not wet, atmosphere. Do not use swabbing methodologies for telling you whether there is residual protein on surgical instruments, because swabbing does not efficiently bring off the protein, and then is usually not a very good chemical test either. Three groups were funded to develop in situ detection of protein on surgical instruments. And then a final result was that, and this was calculations done by the Department of Health's mathematicians, was if you can get the residual protein on a surgical instrument down to less than 5 micrograms on one side of an instrument, not both sides, just one side, we can reduce the risks within the population of transmission of prion protein. So those are the basic rules. How you do them is described in more detail in the HTM.
I don't want to tread where I have no expertise, but I believe there is a debate even about that measurement, but because of the different sizing of instrumentation. Am I correct? So if you have a very small instrument, for instance, in 5 micrograms can be a much bigger population than, say, if you're on a large retractor.
That is true, and I can tell you that the government committee on which I gave evidence to the committee. The scientists gave evidence to the committee. We did not write the outcomes. And I know that committee had a lot of debate about, well, do we keep it simple for SSDs and just say a side, or do we start having to say, well, a square centimeter or this kind of thing, which, of course, nobody can really judge the surface area of an instrument. So we've come out with a figure that is significantly lower than the figure being proposed for the next international standard. But the mathematicians assure us that it's the one that will limit the perpetuation of prion diseases, and particularly now CJD in the population. And maybe even the worry that Alzheimer's can also be transmitted via prion mechanism on surgical instruments. Mm-hmm. Something I forgot to say right at the beginning is whatever this protein is, this prion protein, and we know majority of its chemical structure, but not quite all the details, we know that it sticks to surgical stainless steel like super glue. It really is all proteins are sticky. VCJD is exceptionally sticky.
Yeah, so to really bring this home to our audience, then, I get calls and emails regularly, I'll say maybe once every couple of months, from a department in this situation. They had a procedure. The instruments were brought down. They were processed in the normal manner with all the other instrumentation, same sink, same washers, same autoclaves. And then they get word from the operating room or operating theater to say, oh, by the way, we think this patient might have a CJD. Can you please do something with those instruments? And so in those scenarios, obviously, it's too late to do any kind of isolation of the instrument. So what, under the European standards or under the HTM, what would the process be, or would departments even get in those situations? Are there tighter controls for how these patients are evaluated on the front end so that we don't have to worry about, oh, it's too late, now you tell us?
Yeah, you know, this is obviously very worrying to patients who could have been exposed via an instrument, particularly if it was via a surgical procedure on a neurosurgical procedure or something on the tonsils or back of the eye. All these are very infective sites. So there are worries. I'm not a clinician. I think, you know, that would have to be a discussion with the families. The general view in the UK is that, and the safest way to deal with these instruments is to lock them up in a box and throw the key away. We, at one point, for endoscopes, we maintained on the government's biological research center almost a category 3 store, which contained endoscopes that have been contaminated. And endoscope washing is an even more difficult matter than surgical instrument washing.
Now, you know, Dr. Parrott, we recently did an interview about protein detection, and of course, in a context of all of this, if we're talking about measuring to a handful of microbes at that level, or I should say a handful of molecules, the question then becomes, do sterile processing departments around the globe even have technologies today that could do those types of measurements, even if they wanted to?
The use of the swabbing methodologies are not good. They can lead to false results. Also, the use of some of the soils that are out there that can be purchased, some of them are so easy to wash off. You don't need to do anything other than basically put them in water. So there are problems with that. Technologies are available. As I said, there was 3 devices funded in the UK by the government, 3 research groups, I say, to produce devices that could measure total protein. And that's led to big insights. It shows the methodologies can show you where protein traps on instruments, where it's not necessarily where you think it's going to be at the tip. It can often be in the handle, because that's where the surgeon gloves get contaminated. So there's all, you know, there are problems, but you can see them. And I will say that if you follow the HTM guidelines, don't use swabbing, keep it clean, make sure your instrument, your washer disinfectors are working efficiently and you're using a good quality detergent. And I personally favor the enzymatic detergents, but I know other detergents can work just as well. We've now shown, provided you've optimized your washer disinfector in the first instance, and you check the ability of that washer disinfector to work by using instruments that are contaminated, not tokens.
All right, Dr. Parrott, we're getting right at the end of the interview, but you know, you've done a lot of research. You know where the gaps are. What are the next steps, or what's the uncharted territory that needs to be done as we continue to fight prions?
The potential of something like Alzheimer's, which is much more common than CJD, to be transmitted in a prion-like manner. That's something that's outside my expertise as a analytical chemist to do. That's one. The other problem is the changes in what instruments are made of, the use of ceramics, the use of plastics, and you've got to be really careful that what sticks to those. Just ordinary proteins can stick very easily. And just transmitting an ordinary protein, I don't mean a prion protein, can bring on immunological responses and infectivity. So you've got those. What happens to other surfaces? The use of single-use instruments. And our experience here in the UK is that single-use instruments, there needs to be all new guidelines for the single-use instruments. Some of them I have seen and personally looked at the amount of protein on them. They, as they come in from the Far Eastern countries where they're made, are in a terrible state. They're not fit for use. They're not fit for purpose. So single-use instruments, we need to develop guidelines that are not that dissimilar to that for reusable instruments, and they must be applied to single-use instruments before they can be sold and used on people.
All right. Well, this was an excellent interview. And I actually, you mentioned Alzheimer's, and I remember reading an article that suggested in, I think, a fairly small sample study that instruments could actually have potentially transmitted Alzheimer's during surgical procedures, but the effects did not show up for 30 years.
That's a paper in Nature, And it's a serious worry if that's true.
Yeah, absolutely. And we just scratched the surface. I can definitely imagine you coming back on a future episode. So I just wanted to thank you so much for sharing your expertise and really, I'd say, a good portion of your life's work with us and our listening audience today.
Okay, well, it's been good to speak with you.
That was Dr. David Perrette, professor of bioanalytical science at Barts in the London School of Medicine. We talked about prions and CJD in this episode, Hank. I thought it was kind of interesting when we talked about material composition and just how sticky these prions and especially VCJD are on stainless steel instruments. I definitely think there's room for follow-up on that topic. And then, of course, he mentioned single-use instruments, which are topics we've covered in the past, I believe an episode with Kathy Mazza. So definitely lots of overlap with previous episodes of Beyond Clean, but we've never gotten this in depth. And I definitely have a much better understanding of how prions work and even just how such a very small, naked to the eye, really, amount of residual prion protein, how dangerous that really is.
That's right, Justin. In the growth of the research in this area, as he talked about, he's been doing this, you know, for decades now, but we're just now getting guidance documents like the HTM guidance documents for the UK out into the industry to give some direction to sterile processing and to operating room professionals for how to deal with this in a practical setting. What do you do when this happens, and why is this so dangerous, obviously? But I think getting the professor on with us, you know, obviously he's one of the most well-known researchers in this little niche of not just prions, but prions in the context of sterile processing. Tremendous amount of information in this episode. And I know, as we say all the time, folks are going to be calling us to get him back on the show to talk some more.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. As a reminder, you can help support us by subscribing to Beyond Clean on iTunes or Stitcher and Google Play or Spotify. Simply search for Beyond Clean Podcast. We'd certainly appreciate a rating and a review because your feedback is important to the show. And if you have any topics that you'd like us to cover on a future episode, or if you'd like to share a picture anonymously on our Instagram page, just send an email to info@beyondclean.net. On behalf of Hank, Mike, Bob, and myself, thank you for listening to another edition of Beyond Clean.